politics. Now, did you feel a shudder at the very mention of that incendiary word? Does it make you think of a serene future planned by civilised citizens and their leaders, by us? Or does it remind you of unending frustrations and name-calling? What's the choice? Oliver Freeman is a publisher and businessman who's just helped bring out a book about the future.
Let me begin my talk with some stories. Late in 2012, my partner, Susie Brew, and I returned home to Australia following a holiday in Europe. We landed back home to find a country still deeply mired in the trivia of personality politics. We live in a country where our leaders, whether they're in charge of things or pretenders to the throne, seem unable to communicate a vision for the future that might bind all of us together, however turbulent the whole world might be, and to invite us to collaborate one with another to create a better world. Prime Minister Gillard's trustworthiness, Alan Jones's take on her father, opposition leader Abbott's attitude to women, the continuing mess relating to Peter Slipper and Craig Thompson, these are hardly the stuff that dreams are made of. If Australia's political concerns seemed superficial and not worth the newsprint, they are so different from the concerns of the world we had just left behind, a world full of austerity and paralysis. A week or so in Crete and Athens signalled a clear message that contemporary Greek culture is ill-equipped to embrace such things as austerity measures, not because they are difficult to understand, but rather more because they are fanciful abstractions that have nothing to do with dancing, fishing, ouzo, retsina, eating, talking, loving, and, at a more cerebral level, that have no links to Aristotle, Plato, or Socrates. Who would blame ordinary Greek citizens from seeing the proposed austerity measures as a ramp for keeping the rich rich and the poor in their place? Across the briny in Italy, the political environment had a different hue. The combination of mafiosi, corruption, and continuing repression of women has paralysed the country. Everybody knows what is wrong, but as delightful women friends in Rome informed us at dinner, nobody can do anything about it. So much so that the appalling Berlusconi, or should that be Berlesconi, fancies his chances of being re-elected. England seemed relatively sane, but the impact of the drastic cuts in the public sector are deeply negative as unemployment rises and markets stagnate. The ironic breath of fresh air is, of course, the Boris factor. The podgy elitist eccentric Tory, Mr. Johnson, who's running London with a flair last seen in Australia when Jeff Kennett was giving Melbourne a big boot up its laneways. Back home here in Australia, despite the fact that we are leading the OECD economies following the global financial woes of 2007 and 8, corporations and political parties seem intent on communicating negative messages about our future. And thus, despite our brilliant career in the last 5 years, they conspire to deliver a general sense of pessimism and ennui about the place. One element in this strange situation is the idea that the modern macro economy is manageable. The current preoccupation with the need for our federal government to deliver a budget surplus is a case in point. When the Treasury in Canberra committed Labor to achieving a surplus by 2013-14, it delivered what Oxford philosopher Gilbert Ryle once described as a category mistake. In this case, the premise that we can control our destiny. But if, as all good futurists would contend, the future is unpredictable and unknowable and beyond our control, why on earth would you build government economic policy on the mistaken idea that it was? Even the somewhat pedestrian US President Jimmy Carter realised that the modern economy is not a malleable collection of levers that can be pushed and pulled to achieve a preferred outcome. It is hardly surprising that reports in 2013 now suggest that rising global iron ore prices could put the apparently doomed budget surplus back on track, a matter over which Australian policymakers have negligible, if not zero, influence. This category error impacts greatly on Australian political life. No wonder the Australian political landscape is the drabbest it has ever been. The chimera of economic management and the squabbling that accompanies it take precedence over the deep ethical issues that should be informing public policy. Paul Keating's Redfern speech must have been made from a different place. Spin and excoriation are all that seem to matter in Canberra. Personal vendettas, rather than personal values, rule the roost. It's so mind-numbingly boring and off topic. Prime Minister Gillard recently suggested that the issue of same-sex marriage was one to be determined by Parliament in Canberra, where the numbers are probably against its introduction, failing to notice that the population at large is in favour. I was surprised to learn recently that a former senior Victorian public servant is to become the new chairman of the influential Productivity Commission. This makes him one of the most powerful public servants in our nation. But this is the very same guy who, when introducing my team to 50 key staffers who are undertaking a scenario planning project on the future of primary industries in Victoria a few years back, told the group this: "I've been in the public service for 25 years and nothing has changed, and I don't expect anything will change in the next 25 years." Our project was doomed before we had started. Because of the power and influence on how we create strategies for change, of the way people see the world, we make a lot of fuss about experience and worldviews. I can capture this idea in two ironical thoughts. The first is that it is only by living our lives that we learn how to live the life already lived. How often do you say to yourself, "If I knew then what I know now, I would have done things differently"? Experience is everything. When we bring people together to engage with the future, it's the process of thinking and acting that we do together that makes a difference. A secondary school principal from New South Wales answered my query about the benefit of working on a scenario planning project about the future of teaching in Australia, saying, "Well, it's hard to put my finger on it, but when I sit at my desk and think about the problems we are trying to solve in my public school, I now see the world differently." And this is irony number two. The way we see the world, our worldviews, dramatically shape the future scenarios we create. Nothing is clearer to illustrate this point than the scenarios around climate change. Arguments centre not on the science of climate change analysis over the next 50 years or so, whose content seems to me incontrovertibly to suggest that climate change is and will be strongly influenced by mankind, but on our responses to that science. What should we be doing about it now? Who is accountable and who pays? These two ironies are significant contributions in the long-standing debate about the nature of a social science. Many protagonists of foresight are keen to see the activity achieve the status of a natural science, and like many behavioural scientists before them, seek to create a mind-based quasi-scientific discipline, in this case, that concerns itself about the future of, well, just about anything. Devotees, for example, of the Shell School of Scenario Planning often believe that the scenario planning process is an objective pursuit that will reveal independently alternative futures that are separate from any worldviews that we might individually hold and are resolutely unaffected by our personal experiences. But the reality is that all imagined futures are abstract constructs that are only visible as extensions of the way we see the world and how we got to where we are today. This does not reduce their power or effectiveness. What it does do is to recognise the role of foresight as a tangible means of accessing a world where choices can be made that might deliver sustainable pathways to a better future. So what is missing? What will bring the mojo back to public life in Australia? We clearly inhabit a world of rapid change in which nothing can be assumed to be a constant part of the future. If, as I contend, the future is unmanageable, then what is the importance of foresight and worrying about what might be coming up as the world unfolds? In our book Future Vision, Richard Watson and I set out to appreciate how engaging with foresight might help citizens in Western democracies create a better world. Our first task was to create a framework within which such an endeavour might play out. We took the view that such a framework might be driven by the social psyches that we share, one with another, psyches that we know are not fixed and might express themselves in very different ways depending on the circumstances in which we find ourselves. We chose four broad social characteristics that might drive very different and alternative futures. They are greed, fear, creativity, and caution. And we then designed four imagined scenarios: Please Please Me, Helter Skelter, Imagine, and Dear Prudence, as to what these worlds might be like if we were living in them now. These four worlds are then implicitly compared with a preferred future, so we may think about the generative power of public policy to change the world for the better, from where we are now to where we might want to be. I find the idea of future-proofing public policy an engaging and compelling proposition. A few months back, I was facilitating a project on the future of Sydney, going out to the census year of 2051. The core moment in the project was a full-day workshop that brought together the great and the good from the worlds of urban planning, local and state politics, social action, business and education. The outcomes were positive about the need for new policies and new agendas, but the limitations of the approach taken was the use of planning extrapolations going back as far as 40 years or so. These extrapolations have value, but they fail the foresight test because their assumption is that the future is at the end of a trend line. Unfortunately, trends are not prospective, quite the reverse. They are sourced in the past, and there's no certainty they will continue into the future. Let me talk about cars. When I was a kid, I drove an Aston Martin DB4 at 80 miles an hour down the main runway of a disused airfield in the country at Lassham in Hampshire in the UK. The thrill of it all. I experienced a completely new sense of empowerment. I was 16. Flash forward 50 years. Imagine I'm 16 in 2013. You know, I don't really want to own a motor car. Why spend all that money? I feel really empowered by my smartphone, and you need both hands free to get the best out of it. Funny thing also is I can't imagine why you'd want to live in the burbs. It's the inner city for me, near to my mates, close to restaurants and clubs, and you know I can work anywhere, especially in the hot desk centres sprouting up all over the place. This tiny imagined vignette deeply impairs most current Sydney metropolitan planning activities at a keystroke. But Joe Planner carries on in denial of what is a possible game changer of great magnitude. And we haven't even mentioned global economic catastrophes, peak oil, nanotechnology, the implosion of China, pandemics, or the questionable future of the US. It is not hard to see the value of foresight in the context of the challenge of building a better future. It delivers a crystal clear invitation to us to accept rather than deny the potential impact of those issues I've just mentioned, and many others. Foresight is thus a brilliant platform for change. It encourages us to build frameworks for preferred futures, what we want, and to set against them the alternative futures, scenarios, we might get. This comparing reveals the contestability of our preferences and what we might need to do to transform the reality of what is happening to our preferred destination. Foresight encourages us to embrace uncertainty and to change the conversation that bedevils the political parties of Australia, the mass media, the pulpits of our churches, the corporate boardrooms, and the bureaucracies that run government, education, and research. Foresight cannot, of course, exist on its own, and I would urge the creation of a new estate. This fifth estate would be made up of network individuals and organisations bound together for the sole purpose of creating better futures. Every government department would need to have the capacity to engage in foresight and the capabilities to deliver new policies based on it. Foresight-based would supplement evidence-based as the yardstick against which to measure the strength of policy initiatives. A foresight saga indeed.
Yes, a foresight saga, and he wasn't referring to John Galsworthy. Oliver Freeman is a publisher, and his latest book with Richard Watson is Future Vision, Scenarios for the World in 2040. Next week, Dr. David Mabberley of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney on a future vision for botany. I'm Robin Williams.
It's going to be a big year in Australian education. Putting the Gomsky Report into action will bring about the most significant reforms in a generation. RN's monthly podcast, EdPod, keeps parents, teachers and students up to date with developments in education. In this month's EdPod, the debate on school starting age and how technology is upturning the traditional classroom. If you're not sure how to download EdPod from the RN website, ask a student. They'll know.